This is the podcast for Monday, March 11th, 2013, Theories of Knowledge, Week 10. So this week we have a lot to cover. We have knowledge of morality and politics. Any last comments on religious knowledge, questions, points anyone wants to make about religious knowledge?
It's entirely subjective.
Yeah. Well, is knowledge subjective or are people's beliefs subjective and unjustified?
Beliefs are justified.
Right. This goes back to the whole relativism, objectivism thing. So, relativism or absolutism are sometimes called objectivism. Objectivism versus subjectivism. So if someone believes, and I think of some... It's easy when you have like a falsifiable claim. So it would be a falsifiable claim. Like the Western religions have lots of historical claims. Not just Jesus rose from the dead, but you have the walls of Jericho came tumbling down, and you can see like in the strata there that the walls indeed did come down. Or you have references to kings and peoples and places and geography and all of that, to the extent that we can look, seems to check out. So that's sort of, in favor of, say Judaism and Christianity being historical religions. Whereas you get some other claims, like if you look at the Quran, for example, the Quran, a lot of what it contains are sort of rehashed Bible stories, and Muhammad was not literate. So you get, he doesn't remember the details, or he kind of gets things mixed up. He seems to get, the Tower of Babel story mixed up with the story of Esther. And so he has, he has Pharaoh threatening to crucify his magicians for losing a magical battle with Moses. So you have in the book of Exodus, there's this face-off between Moses and the Pharaoh's magicians. And the Pharaoh's magicians lose. And that's in the Bible. In the Quranic version, in Islam, you have that story. But the added thing, you have Pharaoh, talking about building a tower, reaching to heaven to speak to Moses as God, and also having him threatening to crucify his magicians. So he seems to confuse... And also, you see this guy named Haman showing up there. Haman, the villainous minister of King Ahasuerus of Persia, not Egypt, from the book of Esther. You got the Tower of Babel, which is Mesopotamia, not Egypt. And you have Babylon, right, in modern-day Iraq. And then you have crucifixion. What's wrong with having crucifixion as a punishment?
Because this is the Roman Empire.
Yeah, so not for like 1,000 years later. Yeah, again, different area, right? Italy, not... and I suppose the Roman Empire encompassed a lot of territory, including Egypt eventually. But yeah, crucifixion wasn't a punishment, until thousands of years later. So when you see the claim of Islam that the Quran is perfect in every way, and that even the grammar is perfect, and it's the most perfect book ever written, and it's the only miracle of Islam, you kind of look at what the John Desai, you're saying, wait a minute, crucifixion, mixing Bible stories around, and you assume that the biblical stories, which are, were around, like Islam came around in the 7th century, so the Old Testament is written, all... probably was finished written maybe about 150 BC. So you assume that the earliest stories by the people whose traditions they were most authentic, and then Johnny come lately, Muhammad, who's giving his version of them, is sort of has a strike against him being of a different culture, writing a different language. If there's any authenticity to the traditions, you go with the Jews, you go with the earliest written accounts in Hebrew.
Wasn't that the Avesta with the Zoroastrians? Wasn't that the earliest writings?
Actually, no. You mean the earliest writings of a religion? It depends on what you go. Like earliest extant writings, like physical manuscripts, or if you think about, like, when do people think that this was written? I think Zoroaster was about, it's thought to be about 500 BC. He was a contemporary with the Buddha. I think the biblical traditions go back farther than 500 BC. So, and it depends on how far back do they go. You have references to written manuscripts. Before that, in Judaism. So it's this whole who comes first stuff is always difficult to discern. You know, what are the first written down traditions versus which ones go back the farthest in the oral tradition. So, but what I'm talking about is just like if you think about Judaism, Christianity, Islam. Islam's the last one. And so when you have Muhammad, an illiterate a man who married into money and became a manager of a caravan and has no religious training to speak of and no education to speak of, compared to the writings of the scholars of Judaism that put together the Old Testament, you think, okay, well, these are the original stories, and here's Muhammad's mangled version of that. That's what sort of what an objective person would say. So when you're looking at those stories, you're thinking, oh, well, that's strike one against the Quran, strike two, strike three, when you see all these errors in talking about these original stories. So that might be one way of sort of grading religions and having religious knowledge. Or you look at the Book of Mormon, which actually has a lot in common with the Quran. It's interesting to compare Muhammad with Joseph Smith. Both were charismatic leaders. Both introduced a new religion. Both were really into having lots of wives. Seemed to enjoy a great amount of power and fame from starting their own religion. So if you look at Joseph Smith, one of the things he says is that there was high civilization in the Americas, and particularly in North America. And you look for evidence for that, and it's wanting. And he even has like New World plants. He has Old World plants and animals in the New World. So he has like elephants walking around the Americas, right? There's no elephants in the Americas. And there never were any elephants as far as we can tell. But Joseph Smith didn't know that, right? Because I guess he had like a great school education. What's that?
In North America, there were mammoths.
Elephants?
Yeah. In red carpets.
Okay, like woolly mammoths in prehistoric times.
Yeah.
But there's no
African elephants.
Yeah, African and Asian elephants. Yeah, there may be in ancient times you get woolly mammoths and things. Yeah. Yeah, and the high metallurgy, people going around with coins. You look at the now down in Central and South America, you get some of that. But in North America, it's pretty much the height of civilization was the dugout canoe, right? Some nice baskets, flint tools. They have big giant lodges made of branches and sort of thatch roofs and stuff like that. But you don't even really have stone architecture in North America. And evidence for the Nephites and the Lamanites are supposed to be these giant civilizations, there's absolutely none. And you don't have to take my word for it. You can look on the website for National Geographic or the Smithsonian, both pretty big institutions which deal with archaeology, and they say no evidence for the claims of the Book of Mormon. So if you're, again, trying to evaluate religions, the Book of Mormon is got a big black mark there. Whereas you look at the Bible, there's all kinds of archaeological evidence that the peoples and places referred to actually existed, that many of the events described are just as they're described in the Bible. And archaeologists actually use the Bible to find things. So they look in the Bible and they see, here's where it says the city of Jericho is. Let's see, it looks like that would be right here. Let's dig, right? And it's like, oh, here's the city of Jericho, right? And they find inscriptions referring to various kings referred to, and peoples. And it used to be like in the 19th century, people were very skeptical, saying, oh, it's all mythology. And they start digging around. It's like, oh, here are all those peoples referred to in the Old Testament. Same thing with the New Testament. They find inscriptions, references to people, Pontius Pilate, even some more obscure figures in the New Testament. So if you have a historical claim, a geographical claim, an archaeological claim, those are things you could verify. Same thing with maybe if you make a scientific claim. There's a passage in the Old Testament where the sun stands still.
Yeah.
Okay, what's wrong with this picture? All right, God commands the sun to stand still. Why? Because the fleeing people of the city of Ai, I think it is, they're running away, and the Israelites want to chase them, and they don't want them to slip away in the dark. They want to kill every last one of them. And so God makes the day last extra long. Now, how does he do that? Well, the sun stops in the middle of the sky. And that assumes, you know, that the sun moves across the horizon. It doesn't say, and the earth stops spinning on its axis. It says the sun stood still in the sky. And that's why the Catholic Church persecuted people like Galileo and Copernicus, because it says in the Bible, the sun stood still. That implies that the earth is stationary and the sun's moving around the earth, and not vice versa, as we know is the case today. And so those are just like a couple of examples. And, you know, there might be some back and forth. A person might argue, oh, well, this is just a description in terms of what people would understand at that time. And it's just describing the phenomena of, you see, you know, we talk about David Hume, right? How do I know the sun's going to rise tomorrow? Well, the sun doesn't really rise, right? What happens if there tilts on its axis? So maybe you could have some back and forth. But I'm just saying, it's not as if it's like, oh, either I'm going to take a leap of faith or I'm you know, going to be a skeptic and say I don't believe any of it. You can, you know, argue about the evidence for the various religions and kind of rank them based on the various claims it makes, and maybe even the moral character of the founder, right? So you look at the some of the things that get into moral knowledge. This is one of the arguments, I think, against the inspiration of the Old Testament is God's supposed to be a God who's morally good and benevolent. And you look at the sorts of things that God does in the Old Testament, and it raises a lot of questions about that. Can you think of any examples?
You just gave a pretty good one. Wanting the Israelites to kill every last one of them.
Oh, right.
One of them that's kind of...
Well, you're fighting in a war. You know, you don't want the guys to get away and come back and attack you later on. Well, that's the other thing, is like when they went in and they're like invading the indigenous peoples of Canaan. So the story is that God gave them the land. God didn't send a memo to the Canaanites, or the Canaanites, you know, said, you know, hell no, we're going to keep our land. And then the Israelites came in and invaded. And some of the cities were what were called devoted to destruction. Or there's another way of a more literal way of phrasing it. They're put under the ban. The ban was a ban on taking loot. So for all the other cities, when they went in there, you went in there and you could take whatever you wanted and just, you know, it was yours. But there are certain cities that God has singled out for, you might say, a scorched earth policy or total war, where they're burned down to the ground and everything that lived in the city had to be killed. Men, women, children, little babies, all had to be put to the sword. The entire town had to be burned to the ground. But the precious things of gold and silver and gemstones, those things went into God's treasury house. You can take those for yourself. And so when you think about sort of like God commanding genocide, essentially, it's like, go in here and wipe all these people out, these indigenous peoples, and take their land. And most Americans, you look at, oh, what the pioneers did to the settlers, and you think, oh, that was terrible. But the same person might be like a Bible-believing a Christian or a Jew and say, well, you know, what's the problem? Or sometimes you get sort of mired into tradition where you're unable to ever step aside and say, well, wait a minute, that doesn't seem right. Or sometimes you'll have like liberal Jews, like your Reformed or Reconstructionist Jews that say, maybe they weren't hearing God so good. And, you know, it's inspired, but that just means, you know, that we can learn from it. It doesn't mean that every word is literally true or that you should necessarily do everything it says. But that's sort of a weird attitude to take, too, because why believe any of it? If you see something where it says, think about, like, what are some other examples? So we have God commands genocide. What do you call these?
Dilemma?
It's not really...
Moral contradiction?
How about seemingly immoral teachings or you know, acts of God in the Old Testament. So genocide. Yeah.
Where you take your brother's wife and therefore have more than one wife to take care of. I mean, if they die.
Right, yeah. I'm not sure that one like seems all that bad. Like if the idea is that, you know, women didn't have like jobs and they relied on their husbands. So if your husband died, you'd be reduced to being like a baker or a prostitute or something like that just to get by. But maybe sexism, right? Like that as a fallback. I mean, what you say, it sounds like maybe by modern standards, like, my brother dies, and so now in addition to my current wife, I marry his wife too, or what have you. And that might seem kind of weird, but I'm not sure it necessarily seems immoral. Maybe wife number one wouldn't be cool with it, but. It's like, you know, like your family. It's like sort of like taking in a family member when they're on hard times or something like that. Yeah. But I think why did that happen? Why can't a woman support herself?
Well, it's because of
institutionalism,
like sexism.
The whole idea of a woman's role in society, women's identity revolved around bearing and caretaking for children. That was sort of their role in society. And so it was seen as to be childless is sort of like to be an unfulfilled person. And as today, like a lot of people say, you know, hell no, I'm not having kids or it's just not for me or I got other things I want to do or what have you. But, you know, back then, a woman's role was as keeper of hearth and home and as bearer of children. So, let's see. And actually, you know, the sin of Onan is a good example. Like you heard Onanism, it's supposed to be about masturbation. Actually, the sin of Onan was about that, where he had to marry his brother's wife, but he didn't want to have to divvy up his inheritance among the children he had through her. He only wanted to be his children. And so that's why he basically pulled out at the last minute so he wouldn't impregnate his new wife, so he wouldn't bear any children of hers that would be competing with his children with his first wife for the inheritance. And that was actually seen as a bad thing, so maybe that's a good moral example. Yeah. He's punished for it.
Well, I mean, there was certain... I can't remember what prophet was. I think it was Elijah, who went up and did certain acts, and then all the other priests tried to do the same act, and God engulfed them with flames and killed them immediately. But God just straight up, or opened the ground beneath them and just killed them. Like, that doesn't seem very fair or judicious, does it?
Or in his followers. A lot of these slaughters. I think you're kind of combining the two stories. So the priest of Baal and Elijah, basically, they're having a contest of whose God is bigger or greater. And the priests of Baal call on Baal to come down and consume their sacrifice, and nothing happens. And then Elijah says, well, watch this, and he pours water all over the altar, and then just says, oh Lord, come receive your sacrifice. And hellfire comes down from heaven and consumes the sacrifice. And then Elijah says, we win. And then what do? They slaughter the priests of Baal, and they chase them down and kill them all.
Right.
So, killing a person for their religious beliefs. And when they came into Canaan, when the Israelites came into Canaan, they not only slaughtered people, they also destroyed all their temples, pulled down all their sacred altars and their pillars, and, just basically destroyed all of their religious artifacts. And today we think, well, freedom of religion. And so to think that God says you should kill somebody because of their religious beliefs, doesn't really gel with modern sensibilities. How about human sacrifice? Anybody remember reading about human sacrifice in the Old Testament?
So Abraham and his son.
Yeah, there you go. Abraham and Isaac, right? So a lot of these things that go on in the Old Testament, a lot of people will say it's kind of weird. One man's modus ponens is another man's modus tollens. Throw this expression around at the next cocktail party you're at and amaze your friends, right? So what does this mean? So if you take the same premise, depending on how you look at it, you can derive a different conclusion. So if you start out with God commands genocide, etc., in the Bible. Well, you could go two ways. You could say the Bible is the Word of God. Therefore, genocide is okay under certain circumstances. And maybe the only circumstance is, well, God commands it, otherwise it's right out. But as long as God says to do it, you're okay. Or you could say, God would never command genocide. Therefore, the Bible isn't the Word of God. So depending on, then it comes down to, what's the evidential support for this as opposed to this? Yeah.
Isn't one of the commandments, thou shalt not kill?
Yeah, that one actually has to do with, it's talking about intentional murder. Like, if you look later in the book of Exodus, it distinguishes between premeditated murder and manslaughter and killing in war. And the very next passage, it talks about what to do and, how to fight a war. So it's not talking about killing. And the book of Exodus is full of commandments to how to slaughter an animal too, right? So killing there doesn't just literally mean killing, but it's talking about murder in context.
Well, isn't planning to burn a city to the ground premeditated murder in a way?
Well, that's different though. That's like a religious, it's a holy war.
Oh, okay.
The jihad. Right, to use Islamic terminology, the Jews had their jihad too. Judaism now is a kind of kinder and gentler religion. They put down the jihad and they want you know, peace with the Muslims. But now the Muslims are really into the jihad, and they haven't given that up yet. So who knows what's going to happen? So you can see how. But how do we know this though? Here's a good question. Like this, we talked about religious knowledge, and that might be a difficult claim to establish too. But then, what about this one? How do you know genocide is wrong?
Thou shalt not kill.
Well, that's going back to the Old Testament. The Old Testament's the thing that's saying you should commit genocide, though, right?
Right.
If God says, go kill the Amalekites and kill every last one of them, men, women, children, little babies, and kill all their animals, too, and burn their city to the ground, then you think, that sounds like genocide. That's like ethnic cleansing, right? And genocide is kind of an old-timey word now, I guess. The new... It's hard to keep up with these terms. Ethnic cleansing.
They call it ethnic cleansing.
It sounds like the Nazis now.
You ever heard ethnic cleansing? Look in the Bosnia war there. That's one that came up. Ethnic cleansing. You've never heard that before?
I don't know. It just seems so much like such a weirder way of saying it.
Yeah.
Genocide is just like,
it's
just genocide.
More vulgar.
Yeah, it's like, you know.
More offensive in a way.
Yeah.
Like, differently able or something.
It makes it sound positive in a way.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
Well, that's just how they would do it. So, like, the committers would say.
Yeah.
I think this is made up by people that think this is a bad thing, this term.
You did a terrible job of showing, so.
Yeah, that's good. I never thought about that as being a positive thing.
Bad drawing.
Yeah, genocide, the word genos means nation, so it means, or people, so it means destroying a whole group of people. So yeah, I like genocide, yeah.
I think
the word.
Yeah, I think this totally threatens, like, the whole idea that God is a perfect being.
Uh-huh.
Because, I mean, he created all this, and I don't know, it really threatens that.
It's different too, because, like, you know, God, there's this claim that God is good. You think, well, wait a minute, if God is good, how can he command genocide? So there might be an internal contradiction. But then, can't you always come back and say, well, maybe genocide is good? I mean, look, one of the reasons why, according to the Bible, why the Israelites had such a hard time is they left too many people alive. They didn't follow orders, and they didn't kill all the Amalekites, the Jebusites, and the Perizzites, and all those other ites that are there in Canaan. They left them alive. And what happened? Well, they had a rebellion, and then they had contamination of the pure religion of Yahweh, their God, and it got mixed in with idol worship. And then when they started worshiping idols, then God had to punish them by sending in foreign invaders, and lots of people died in a lot of wars, and there was oppression, and lots of bad things happened as a result of their not following God's commands, according to the Old Testament. Or, let's add a fifth one. I mean, that's kind of a tough one, right? This idea that God loves you so much that he sent his only son to die in your stead. So just believe in him, because if you don't, God's going to burn you up in a fiery pit forever and ever. You'll be in agony, and you'll be crying and gritting your teeth because it's so painful and you feel so terrible and lost. And yeah.
I don't know. The only thing I could say is that we think it's morally wrong to do so, since God was supposed to have created us and he gave us this idea of morality, then maybe it's that we're supposed to go through with that gut feeling and be like, no, I don't think that's a good idea. Like, maybe it's one of those tests or whatever.
That reminds me of a story in Omni magazine, just published by Bob Guccione of the now, you know, fallen penthouse empire. Damn internet porn. Ruined my business. So anyway, Bob was also a sci-fi buff, though, and he published Omni magazine. And he has a story. It's basically the Garden of Eden story. But when Adam eats a forbidden fruit, or Adam and Eve both eat the forbidden fruit, God says, good job, you passed the test. Mm-hmm. That was what you were supposed to do. Not like in the biblical story where that's like the original sin that puts the whole human race under a curse, and the earth as well. How about like predestination? Get some passages in the Bible that say that God picked certain people before the foundation of the world to be with him in heaven, and everybody else goes to hell by default. And only those who are called by the Spirit of God, the ones who were chosen beforehand, get to go to heaven. And that nothing those people did made them worthy. It's all God's choice, not based on anything they did. Doesn't seem very fair to me. Or what about God's going to send me to hell for being a sinner? Why am I a sinner? Oh, I'm a child of Adam. I'm descended from Adam. And when Adam sinned, every human being ever since has inherited this propensity to sin. So Adam sinned, and his sin passed on to me, but why am I being held responsible for what Adam did? I didn't vote for him. You know, why is he my representative? So you end up with these sort of moral paradoxes. And, you know, Christians and Jews, they, you know, worry about these things. But at the end of the day, they say they have to make a choice. And either it's to go along with what the text says or to try to kind of tweak it with modern sensibilities and say, well, okay, you know, you got to live in the modern world. Or maybe it's not inspired as inspired as we think it was, or what have you. So, but how do you know, like, when you say, like, this isn't fair, right? You say something's not fair. You know, like a believer will say, well, of course it's fair. God commanded and God is just. How do you know it's not fair? And they would say, you're trusting your fallen human nature and your beliefs about what's fair. And because you're like a morally corrupt, degenerate human being, of course you're going to think it's unfair. But it's perfectly just because God would never command anything that isn't perfectly just. So how would you respond? Like, how would you say you know? How would you show that person that predestination would be unfair? Yeah.
Well, I mean, they're putting this label on God that he can do no wrong, he's perfect, he's divine, and I mean, there are multiple reasons why I would argue that. And so, if you believe that he is, if one could prove or would have reasons like I have that he is not perfect, then you can say, well, he doesn't just get a jail free card, you know, for, you know, just because he's pure and divine. If you can prove that he's not 100% pure and divine, then the things that he are clearly doing that are not, you know, okay, then he would just get out of jail free with them.
Okay. I'm trying to remember people's names as we were in the last week. What's your name again?
I'm Courtney.
Courtney, right. And Courtney and Matt, I know from previous classes.
It seems like kind of a circle argument to me. They just say that God is just, and then it falls back on the fact that, well, if God is who he says he is, then part of him is being just. And it's like, okay, well, that's like kind of reaching to base, like, so many things, like from genocide to potentially burning in hell forever, all these things just on the fact that he may or may not exist. And that's what it comes down to for most people, it seems like.
Well, let me put it this way. Like, could you make an argument against, say, Christianity based on the fact that predestination or this concept of hell is unjust or cruel or barbaric or what have you? But then how would you establish this idea that where do you get the sense of, where do you get the principle of fairness and unfairness, of justice, of goodness? Where do those things come from?
I think from all the experience on earth, how we live our lives.
That's what we believe in, instead of believing in the God that these people have come up with. We believe in what our concept of justice and morality is.
But who's we, though?
Whoever wants to believe in whatever they want to believe. Yeah.
So it's whatever you believe is good and right.
I would say.
what you think is good and right, you think is good and right, but that may not be the same to other people. But that's up to you.
So whatever I believe is right for me. So if I believe in, like raping co-eds and throwing their bodies in the Willamette River, or so that's my thing, right? So that means that's right for, as long as I think it's nothing wrong with it, to me, tell me, prove it's wrong. Or maybe I just like go after like prostitutes, and I'm like, well, the world needs fewer sluts and whores in the world, so I'm gonna like kill prostitutes and throw their body in the Willamette River.
Just circling up all the Jews and sending them to camps and burning them in ovens.
Well, I'm just saying, like, does that? It seems like even if I say, if I believe that's true, does it mean it is true? Just because I think it's okay.
God is true, or if you say you believe God is true, does that mean that God is true? From the same point that you believe in this,
you just said that anything that's true, something is true.
Yeah, so I just provide a counterexample. Yeah, and what's your name again?
John.
John, right.
It seems like most people in most societies decide what is moral from the society's point of view, or like how people react emotionally to the idea of something. Like you saying, what if your thing is going out and killing women and throwing them in the Willamette River? There's a pretty wide, like, shock value. And that's what we as a culture will emotionally feel when something like that happens. Whereas there could be cultures elsewhere that don't really see that as something that is emotionally jarring.
So how about another word for that is cultural relativism, if you think society is the...
Well, I think the society promotes what emotion we end up having.
But what if your society believes gas the Jews, conquer the world, destroy the defectives, like the cripples and the retards, just like kill them all, and only the pure Aryan blood must be preserved. That's like a society. Nazi Germany was like a society which embodied militarism and racism and cultivated attitudes of cruelty and
what is this?
It also has a lot of people who want to leave. And
well, that's true, but I mean that's
to them.
But if you think that if you think the culture sets the standards, here's a culture which most people would say has really bad standards. But would you say that would, like, if you're living in Nazi Germany, that's what you should do? Like, assuming the majority supports that viewpoint. That would say it's morally justified.
Well, how would they say it's morally justified to do the same thing with genocide? Like, they have the same, like, religious view that it's okay to do all this, and if you believe in God, then you're, if you are an absolutely blind believer in God, then you'll go kill people just because somebody else that you trust is the prophet of God says that he said that. Like,
right,
crazy.
Well, I want to stick with this. Like
that person, that I would say that person is raping and killing. Okay, if you believe it, I would call that person crazy.
Okay, well, that's a couple of things. I want to get away from like the religious knowledge a little bit and go back to like, let's suppose you're going to try to show this religious person that look, you have all this bad stuff in your holy text, and these ethical principles are valid. And they conflict with your text, so believe in these principles. And if you do believe in these principles, you have to get rid of that text, or at least change your view about it in some way. So you had your hand up earlier.
Well, I think that there are some underlying intercultural, like across the board, moral like standards that we have as humans, and I just think that that like unless that there is a divine reason for wanting to break those moral codes, then it's really it's based on like the majority rules, and we as people with free will fight the Nazis.
But if it's majority, which majority? If you're talking about the majority of society, the majority of Germans were on board with Hitler. He like got elected.
But we're not just one culture majorities. Anymore. I mean, we're like a human race, and we
so all. Like the human race. You're like no. All humans?
Mm-hmm.
Or human nature? This is actually what David Hume says in Nature. But then how do you tell, like, what... Do you, like, just look at, like, what every culture in the world believes and try to find similarities or something?
Yeah, that's what, like, Joseph Campbell did.
Well, the problem with that is that you end up with people with all kinds of different beliefs. Like, you look at, like, a big part of the world, like in the Middle East and Africa and Latin America, there's a lot of sexism. And there's strongly defined gender roles. In the West, it's more egalitarian. How do you tell which is the right one? Does that mean if you have 4 billion people who say narrowly defined gender roles and 3 billion people that say no, more egalitarian, that you go with the majority of human beings believe or practice? Courtney.
Yeah, I mean, I think that just taking the overall, like, just taking the number of people and saying whoever the biggest group of believers is, we need to take their belief. I think that's really dangerous because, say in Africa or the Middle East, I mean, like sexism, I mean, that's an entire one section, like that, and generally, one group will have power over the other. I mean, with the Nazis, you have power over the other, or with a lot of regimes in Africa, you have power over the other. So, I mean, I think it's dangerous. I think a better way of saying it, and I'm hesitant to use a quote from something else, but I think for me, it would be do unto others as you would.
Do unto others as you'd have them do.
Because, I mean, generally speaking, you ask someone, would you like to be murdered right now? No. Okay. Would you like to be raped right now? No. Okay. The girl up front said there are things across the board, and I think that's kind of in the realm of what I'm saying, but more that I think that's a good, like, that would be a good way of looking at it. And I'm not sure if that would work to answer your question, but I think that's how I would put it. I mean,
most people would say that's a pretty good rule, although you can kind of get as you would have.
There are some, yeah. I mean, obviously there are people who commit suicide and things like that that are really fine with it.
Well, there are people that have different preferences, yeah. Right? So, I might not care if something's done to me, but somebody else might care about it. Like, somebody might say, I hear some of my friends say, I don't mind being groped by the TSA or being stopped at drunk driving checkpoints or having the government snooping in my email. And so therefore, it's okay for the government to do it to other people. Whereas, a lot of other people do care. Or I don't care if drones are flying over here or they can take out an American citizen without a trial. But a lot of other people do care. So it's a question about, how can you state that in a way that's general enough that it's not going to legislate your own preferences?
I don't think it's specific enough. I just think it's a good, starting point, you can say.
Well, how about this one? How about do unto others before they do unto you? Why isn't that a better rule?
That doesn't really follow my rule at all.
Well, I know, but I'm just saying, like, why is your rule better than my rule?
It sounds like your rule promotes violence and death.
It seems like violence and death is a generalized thing. No, it's violence and death to others, but not to me. But it's preservation of my life. Like, why should I? Mean, why even the whole question of morality? Why should I even care about other people? Why is that? I mean, some people spend their whole lives helping other people. But why isn't that like a complete waste of time?
Because
why should I care about, benefiting society?
Because in some way it satisfies your ego.
What's posterity ever done for me?
I guess as human beings have a conscience. I think that's why we do.
But then there's this whole idea of conscience. Like, what is that? What does that even mean? What is a conscience?
I can't really explain why. I mean, can you explain why you say hi to somebody with a smile on your face? Or why? I mean, not everything
Well, I mean, there's a couple of ways of going. Like, you might say, like, with this human nature, the human here, and Hume talks about this as being non-rational moral sentiment. And we might sort of a modernized version, this idea of evolutionary morality. That, why do you smile? Well, it's a submissive gesture. It means, I'm a friend, don't attack me. It's like you look at, you know, chimpanzees, right? And when the one chimpanzee is, you know, when there's like a fight or confrontation, the other guy, don't kill me, right? Don't stop hitting me, or what have you, right? It's a way of crying uncle. And then that gets sort of, you know, bred into the gene pool, and it's like you see a stranger, and it's like, hi, I'm your friend, don't attack me.
Well, you could say it about anything, but, you know, why do you get upset when your friend is crying? Or why does it make, you know, you sick to your stomach when you hear about someone being raped? I mean, you could say it's all, there's a root to all of it, but I'd say there's, you know, a million different things. You could say, well, why does this happen? Why do you feel this way?
Yeah, you would say, like, you know, today we can point to things like mirror neurons. Mirror neurons. So mirror neurons, and we take one of those site sequences. Let's talk about what mirror neurons are. Remember that? Nope. Well, I'll say what mirror neurons are then. So you have this part of your brain that when you see someone in a certain state, you react and get in that state too. It explains things like sympathy, squeamishness, the fact that when someone yawns, you feel like yawning. So it's like if you think about that movie Idiocracy, right? And there's that the hit show, and if you remember the hit show and Idiocracy,
Ow
my balls, right? And any guy can relate to this. You see somebody get hit really hard in the crotch, and you go, oh, like that. You sort of, you know, like you're protecting yourself. And sometimes you kind of put your legs together, and you're like, oh, right? You kind of get down like that. And it's like, you know, why? It's because, like, you remember, like, if you've been hit really hard there before, you remember how it feels. And, or, I don't know, I was watching on YouTube some skater kid. And this guy was like this skinny beanpole guy, and he's doing these skateboard tricks, and he falls and tries to catch himself on his bony little arm, and it just snaps like a twig. Like, I even heard some people like gasp when I just said those words, right? And that's that Hume says this is an irrational association we have with the suffering of other people with our own. You think about this, just like it's a YouTube video. I don't even know who this guy is. It's my arm's just fine. Why am I all of a sudden acting as if I've been hurt?
Well, if that's the case, then, I mean, say your friend, you were standing next to your friend, he got kicked in the balls. And, I mean, if we're taking Hume's rule or opinion, I mean, you would just walk away so you can get away from you. You don't have to see that anymore, so you don't feel that way anymore. You said later, I'm getting as far away from your actions as I can. I think most people would say, hey, man, you all right? You know, like,
well, Hume would say, actually, the reason why you say, oh, are you all right, is because you feel the injury at some level with yourself, because your mind says, oh, he's acting like I act when I get hit in the balls.
Well,
right?
It, remembering it, though, and this thing that happened. You said it's, you remember.
Well, what happens like an unconscious level, right? It's like, it's sort of like if your friend's driving too fast, you ever like drive, or maybe you're driving real fast, you see your friend and their foot starts like twitching while they're like trying to push down the gas pedal, or the first time the brake, not the gas pedal, but the brake, right? Or it's just, it's an irrational association of my suffering with other people. Why do I get squeamish? Why do I faint at the sight of other people's blood instead of just fainting at the sight of my own blood? Well, it's this irrational association I have with the suffering of other people, with my suffering, because inside my subconscious mind it says, oh, it would feel really bad if that happened to me. And it's happening to this person, and the mirror neurons they sort of kick in, and they say, oh, this is really bad, and make sure that doesn't happen to you, and you get this feeling of sympathy.
Well, I think it kind of goes deeper than just like watching and observing other people. Like when you're a parent and you're trying to keep your offspring alive, like I think that that is a mechanism that gets keeps your children alive and like teaches you to like teach your children not to kill themselves.
Yeah, familial solidarity. And then when you get, so you have this idea that kinship ties are really important. And what do you want to do as a creature of evolution? You want to pass on your genes to the next generation. And so you're not just like your son or your daughter, but your brother, your cousin. You want to make sure that they live too. And, you know, as a family group, if you work together, you're going to be more successful than family groups that are always squabbling. And so this sort of, there's this built-in idea of social cohesion. And then when human beings started living in extended family groups, being able to work together, it has a lot of evolutionary advantage. And so you have this idea of the tribe, the clan, right? It's, you're talking about the genes, even the tribe. But then human beings have this capacity for abstraction. And so they think, oh, well, metaphorically, you know, think about the human family, right? Human family. But you think about, there's no real, literal human family, right? But it's kind of a metaphor for this idea, well, why don't we think about the world as one big family? Let's all hold hands and pretend we're brothers and sisters and sing a song or something, right? So that's the sort of idea of so humans say this is all there is to morality, is this sort of generalized feeling of sympathy, of obligation, of benevolence, of wanting to be kind to people. Why? Because it starts out as sort of this, you think, well, I like it when people are kind to me, going back to what Courtney was saying, right? This idea of do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. It's this reciprocal feeling of sympathy that people have. Matthew.
I want to ask you about the statement, your statement, just the Bible is the word of God.
Are we going back to religious knowledge? I want to stick with the ethics.
Well, no. I mean to prove to a religious person that the genocide that they're talking
about. Okay, the genocide is immoral or something, so the Bible is not the word of God?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So God didn't write the Bible, right? Somebody else wrote it, yeah. Right? So how could it be that He doesn't command exactly genocide, right? The Bible doesn't say, go to this place, we're located exactly here, and disembowel these people exactly this way and this way. Right?
Well, you do actually get quotes when God speaks to particular people. It says, you know, the word of the Lord came to so-and-so saying, and then you get, like, you know, essentially quote marks saying, here's what God said.
Well, yeah.
And then you get stories about what God did.
But then it's open to interpretation. So He doesn't say exactly to do all these things. These people think that this is what He means, and then they take it upon themselves to go out and do this. What if they just interpreted it wrong?
Yeah, so you might, but then, like, the Bible, you know, the question is the Bible really the Word of God? Or, you know, the Word of God with a bunch of qualifiers or something?
Well, no, not even that. Just that, how do you know that you, I don't know how to say it.
We might. I mean, I think we're back on religious knowledge again. But I see what you mean. There's like this question about how do you know that people were hearing from God, hearing God right?
Yeah, just yeah. Because people. Every time I've been to church, it's somebody reading from the Bible and it's them interpreting the story in their own different ways. And I've heard different priests say different things about the same story. So it's just. It strikes me as odd that they would think that everybody that has this just unanimous kind of idea that it's okay when somebody speaks up and then obviously he's the wrong one. Well, how do you know that he's the wrong one? Just maybe not enough people want to believe him enough to speak up and support him because you killed him too fast or something like that.
Okay, well, let's come back to think about morality, just that qua morality. So we talked about like this human idea that it's all feelings. Feelings.
Nothing more than feelings,
right? So Hume says it's all irrational, right? Because you think about something that happened to a friend of yours, say, anybody have anything bad happen to a friend? Not too bad, I'm pulled down.
Like I had a friend that had their house broken. Broken.
I got to say.
My friend had his house broken.
House. Well, something happened to you though. So, okay. Well, let's say so. So I'm like, oh, that's too bad, Courtney. I bet it really hurt to get punched in the face, right? So I got punched in the face once when I was like, I don't know, 15 or something like that. I remember how it felt, and I remember being angry, and I remember how it hurt. You know, I was like, oh, and you know, so I'm like react sympathetically to that news. So that's the human say. I'm just that's like that's a weird association because the guy that punched you has nothing to do. It has no causal relation to the guy that punched me. And whether you got punched in the face has no effect on like you know how my jaw feels today or anything. So
how would he explain the reaction of wanting of me? Say my friend gets punched in the face and I want to go beat up the guy who punched my friend in the face. How would he?
Oh, he would say that's you know that's the idea that your friend. I mean, you have some. Positive feelings towards your friend, and someone attacks something that you value, then you want to punish that person and make them feel bad.
But that would explain his mirror neurons.
Well, it's like the friend. I mean, friendship's like a relationship, and Hume might say it's sort of like a expansion of the sort of kinship ties, right? It's the same feeling you would have towards your brother or a family member.
But isn't his whole argument that it's all about you? It's actually all a sort of reflection of what you're feeling?
You're thinking if somebody punched me in the face, it would make me really angry. I don't want to hit that guy back. And so since you have this close relationship with your friend, it's like in punching your friend in the way that it punched you, at least in your mind, that's the way it works. Now, Hume doesn't know anything about mirror neurons, but he does know about human nature and this idea when someone hurts someone we love, it's like in a way it hurts us. Even though it doesn't literally hurt us, our mind makes this association.
Who was mirror neurons? I thought that was Hume.
Sorry, the mirror neurons is like a modernized version.
Okay.
You know, Hume's writing in the 18th century. Those before neurophysiology. But modern day people that do sociobiology or evolutionary psychology says this explains what Hume was talking about. Yeah.
But that's not always the case. As a rational human being, I can look at my friend and be like, well, what were you doing to deserve to be punched in the face? I mean, I don't always sympathize with them just because they're my friend or my child or whatever.
Yeah, so that's a good point. It might be, though, that there might be other principles that aren't just directly tied to kinship that are more abstract. So this idea of you had it coming or something like that, where might that come from? I mean, it might just be like a version of... Like, the idea that someone deserves something. Maybe it has to do with a person who does something which is bad for the tribe or bad for the family, and then that person gets punished so they don't do it again. Like, the guy is, I don't know, he's, what might somebody do? Suppose you're out hunting, and one of your hunting party is talking loudly and scares away the animal you're hunting, right? And you get back to the village and the guy gets a whipping or something like that. And so the idea that if you do something to endanger the community, then you ought to be punished. But it's sort of, and this kind of comes with more of the evolutionary idea, I guess, that if you do something to endanger the community, then there's this feeling that you got to stop that. And the way to stop somebody from doing something again is by punishing them. So giving them what they deserve.
Not everybody thinks the way to stop somebody from doing that is by punishing them. There's a lot of people in the world that would think like positive reinforcement would be a better way to do that instead of going out and hurting them. People that we typically see as like kind of animalistic or savage-like would resort to that before they would go to the point of trying to explain it through words or something like that.
There's two S's.
not like a cherry pie or something. Mm-hmm. Like the idea of what get a person getting a just desserts, or this could be a positive thing too. Like think about you read a news story about some woman who devoted her life to helping the less fortunate, and she's murdered by some gang member for the $17 in her purse, right? So you feel two things. You feel like sympathy for this woman. You feel like she didn't deserve that. She deserved better. And then the gang member, you think, oh, that guy, something really bad ought to happen to him. He needs to be punished. And so where does that come from?
I would say that comes from my concept of justice. I think that justice was not served there.
But where does justice come from? The concept of the idea of justice.
It's a relation to everything we've been talking about.
Well, and is this just a feeling? You're thinking, oh, well, if that was my wife or my daughter, or if that was me, you know, that would be really bad. And so I think about this person is like me, and this is because they're a human being, an innocent human being, and they were doing something good, and they had something bad happen to them.
Well, with justice, it doesn't really matter where you get the conclusion from, as long as you get the right.
That may be true as a matter of practical knowledge, but not as a matter of philosophy. So, like, we try to do philosophy to figure out what's going on. And I suppose if you think it's justice is just an irrational feeling of moral outrage and some other feelings, then maybe there's no legitimacy to it. Maybe morality is a crock. And that has implications for how much you pay attention to it. Matthew?
Maybe that was her reward. Maybe the next day that city gets hit with a nuclear warhead and she would have died a much more horrible death, but God sent that gangbanger to that corner to rob her for $17 so that she wouldn't feel that pain. That was his idea of this is a better option for you.
Possible, I didn't see very probable though.
Well, that sounds like with genocide. Like,
we're going back to the genocide.
Genocide, they don't care about the person. They're just murdering them because they don't want them around.
I mean, some people have
their beliefs.
But they don't care. They're not saying we're murdering this person so they don't have to experience the worst pain.
Yeah. But this is. Some people suggest that moral intuitions are where we ought to start. That you can't take something like justice and say, oh, it's just feelings. Because feelings might be an explanation, but it's not a justification. So what's the difference between an explanation? That should be up here. Feelings are an explanation, but not a justification. Not a justification. Okay, explanation. Barbadale was under a lot of pressure during the winter term, and he had his department chair breathing down his neck to finish those reports. And he had a lot of things going on, and the five cats was getting to be too much. So it's understandable he just snapped and beat his wife that fateful March afternoon, or what have you. That's an explanation, right? But it's not a justification. A justification would be, and this is why she had it coming or something, right? So that when she said, can we have another cat? So you think about the idea of just the explanation. This is why people have these moral feelings. This is why when you read about some woman being raped and stabbed to death or something as she was going to her job as a social worker, you feel a sense of moral outrage. Or when you read about human rights abuses, you feel moral outrage. Or when you read a story about some woman who finds like a bag full of cash
in the gutter and turns it in and gives it back to the person who it belonged to, even though she's like living at the poverty level. You're like, oh wow, there's still honesty in the world. And where do all those feelings come from? And Hume says, oh, it's just human nature. We have this thing that's part of human nature where we associate these actions of others with things that might happen to us in the future or have happened to us in the past. It's all irrational. Right, that's different from, here's why you should be moral. Here's the reason why you actually should be, you should behave like this. Here's why you should give the money back too, and so on and so forth. Yeah, Courtney?
Well, I think this is all, I mean, it's kind of all the same argument to me, because, like, I mean, human beings are beings of emotion. I mean, that's just what we are not. It's impossible to be without emotion. And so, I mean, I think that one could make an argument based on emotion that is justified, saying, you know, I can take these reasons, you know, why a person feel this way or why our emotions are affected this way, and then go off of that and then try to justify it. But I don't think that you can just make an argument without emotion. I mean, you know, saying someone doesn't want to die, that's an emotion. Or saying, you know, love, or that's an emotion. You know, anything that you that build, you know, hard reason off of or facts off of to justify something being moral or not, I think you would have to base off of some form of emotion.
With feelings? But then how can you have, like, a moral discussion about moral principles? It'd be like, I like chocolate ice cream, you like peppermint or whatever. Chocolate, it's so chocolatey, and you'd say, but peppermint, it's so pepperminty, right? There would be, like, nothing you could say because each person feels the way they do.
I
can't tell you what you should feel. What if I say, I tell you some story of injustice, and you're like, that doesn't really outrage me. I don't understand why you're so upset about, you know, drones killing American citizens on American soil. And they might be terrorists, and the government probably knows best who to kill without trial or charges.
Well, that's why there's obviously never, there's not one perfect thing to overrule everyone's opinion. I kind of just comes back to, what we were talking about earlier, you could say the majority of people would think that they would not want to die, so don't kill people. I hate to come back to that again, but
so majority rules.
Like whether you like strawberry ice cream or not, there's like 100 different kinds of ice cream. There's going to be 100 different answers. There's really only one or two answers between whether you think.
We're assuming that there's no valid answer, then. It's just
the whole
issue. I'm assuming there's one general answer that most people would agree on.
But then, where does that come from? Like, why do people agree on it?
Because dying hurts.
So you think it comes back to human nature?
I don't know if I would call it human nature. I would just call it, whatever you want to call it, whatever.
But think about, like, a person. I mean, people have all sorts of, like, attitudes and feelings that are based on misconceptions. Like, the reason people are racist, they have all sorts of false beliefs about people of other groups.
Not only false beliefs, but you said false beliefs.
No, there are people, they have false beliefs about people of other groups. That's why they hate certain people, right?
Well, explain to me how anything that I've said that would be a general belief on people would be a false belief.
Well, I'm just saying, like, you're going to go with, like, the majority? All human beings on the planet, or what?
I mean, no, I don't necessarily want to say majority, because that can be dangerous, but, it is partly majority, because, like you said, there are people that, little differences in their beliefs, so, maybe one person wouldn't mind, I don't know what one of the examples gave was, but people not being able to vote, and someone else would care about that. I mean, there are differences, but
It seems like if you're just going with emotion, it's nothing to it. It's just all, like, why should I be moral? It's just, okay, human beings have these feelings. Most people feel like this, but then it comes down to, what should I do? Why shouldn't I steal office supplies, cheat on my taxes, screw over my business partner if I can get ahead.
Comes from though, like you wanna go to college. That comes from emotion, or you wanna like play sports. That's my. I feel like almost everything comes from.
Well, there's partly emotion, but then there's the question of like what I should do. It might be one. It may be that I really want to do one thing, but I think but that would be wrong, right? You think about emotion like I really want. Like, you have a chance, like, to, you're in a monogamous relationship, you have the chance to put a little something on the side, and you think, oh, and your emotion might say, this is really good, but then you think, oh, that would be wrong, that I should do that.
It's like rational self-interest. You want to please whatever emotions you have, but you have to be rational about it.
Mm-hmm. So,
I think emotion, in the end, is what triumphs reason in a lot of
cases. Depends on who you
are. You had your hat for one.
But action always triumphs over emotion. So really, it doesn't matter what you feel; it's what you do.
That's true. What motivates people to do what they do? So
yeah, willpower.
But your emotions and your beliefs aren't unrelated, right? Like yeah. So desire might motivate you, but or your feelings might motivate you, but where do your feelings come from? They come from your understanding of the facts. Like I have a friend, and he loves President Obama, but he has all this sort of crazy like pedestal beliefs. Like he compares him to like Jimmy Stewart and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and thinks about him as being this pure principled individual instead of like another shyster politician, which is the actual case. And another shyster millionaire lawyer politician, right? So, but because he has all these false beliefs about President Obama, because he hasn't read his two autobiographies, because he gets all his news from The Daily Show, you know. So it's like he has this idealized conception of the president. So because he has these false beliefs, he has these feelings that go along with it. So the feelings don't just come out of nowhere. So the question is, like, where do these feelings about morality come from? And is that enough to base your moral decisions on? Just, oh, I feel like this, I feel like that. Most people feel like this. It doesn't seem like something you can hang your hat on, anything that would have any solidity to it or could provide a foundation for. When I have a moral dilemma, what should I do? Oh, well, most people feel like you should do this. Does that really tell me anything about what I should do?
It seems like you're clouding what is not as clouded an issue.
Are you saying, like, follow your heart? Well, I mean, what if the reason I have a dilemma is because I have conflicting feelings, right?
But you're going to make a decision based on what you come to, but you're not just going to say, oh, well, I should do that just to.
Oh, based on empty, like what does that even, I mean, what am I?
A combination of your reason and your emotion.
Just imagine a situation where your emotion and your reasoning are not allowing you to make a choice. At that point, then you can't really find an explanation for.
I'm looking for like a moral principle that says, here I have these conflicting feelings and ideas and beliefs. Where is a moral principle like the one you suggested earlier, which is you and others as you would have them do unto you? Or Kant calls this the categorical imperative, that you know, act as if your action were a universal law of mankind, so that everybody follow this principle.
Maybe there is no moral.
Yeah, you're asking.
Well, there you go. So you're left as a nihilist, and then we're back to slicing up the prostitutes and throwing their bodies.
Your ass is maybe one, like.
It's like, well, that's true. Your...
You don't need to be nihilist. I mean, you don't need to be like pessimistic to like believe that there is no moral.
So you think like the reason why you shouldn't commit mass murder is you'll end up in jail or something?
Yeah, you have to rationalize your emotions into the action based on what you know is going to be the.
Well, if the only reason I shouldn't be immoral is because I may get caught and then I might get put in prison, then it seems like I should just make sure I don't get caught, right?
That's rational too.
But it seems like that seems like the height of immorality. It seems like if morality is a crock, then I don't know. But then you're left with this idea that like you read about some story of, I don't know, human degradation and misery at the hands of another human being, and you're like, that's so terrible. But then you have to say, oh, that's just that weird, irrational feeling. It's nothing. There's nothing real about it. It's just, it makes me feel bad because I'm a human being.
Why is it irrational? Why doesn't that feeling like bring everyone together, like? If everyone gets upset about that thing, maybe that's who you're supposed to be with.
It's just stimulus response.
That's who your tribe is supposed to be.
It's just like, oh, it's just like it's just like a you know, it's a reflex action.
So it's not irrational that it doesn't make any sense. It's irrational that you can't explain it.
It just, it's irrational in the sense it's not based on anything in objective reality. It's just a feeling you have. It's like a reflex. And it's, there's no moral reality behind it. There's really no such thing as justice and injustice, cruelty and kindness, except for, you know, maybe it's socially defined. So there's no right or wrong, good or evil. It's just like, there's just things that produce some certain kinds of feelings and things that produce other kinds of feelings.
You can't have even a concept of cruelty and justice without your feeling. You can't look at it well. That one, you like, it just brings you back to saying, like, well, why would that? Why is this wrong? Why is this immoral? And like, I can just come up with no reason why I could argue, well, this is bad, you know, without you saying, you know, emotion as a part of it.
So there's, if bad is just a feeling, then why should I care?
Like, what would you say? Well, it's bad to kill people. Why? Why is it bad to kill people?
Yeah, that's a good. That's my question.
Well, that's my answer. Because
it makes people feel bad.
Yes.
Why should I? So that's all it means. To say something's evil just means it makes people feel bad.
I can't come up with anything else other than that.
Well, there's other physical consequences besides emotions to killing someone. Like, it's messy. Like, you know, they have kin left over that you're going to have to take care of now. There's like things in the real world, like their kin left over, they're not provided for anymore.
Oh,
things like that.
Okay, I see that people are getting restless. Well, I got two more comments here. So, Matthew and then Patrick.
You said that, well, people believe in God, right? And you said that emotions are part of belief. So how are these emotions that people feel not these mere neurons? How is this belief in God just not everybody that believes in God mirroring that person who really believes in God?
Okay, I'm going to let that one sit because we're getting back to the God thing. Patrick?
What about the people who can turn their emotions off? Like a soldier, you know, fighting, you know, going over country, killing kids and, you know, killing people. But then when they come back and they see their own families and their friends, you know, then the emotions hit them. And they break down. Like, they're not actually feeling what they're doing when they're, you know, going over there, like, doing their job.
Yeah, you think they should have, like, a person to be moral would have be consistent and have moral principles, and that their emotions would follow suit with the moral principles and be integrated with them. They wouldn't be leading with their emotions. Because emotions are fickle things. They come and go. You can turn them on and off and on. They're contextual. Whereas moral principle is something that's more universal and lasting and, you know, will apply to you whether you feel like it today or not. And so that's why I think, like, the human account seems like it's, you know, it doesn't really give you a robust concept of morality that most of us assume in our everyday actions. So we'll talk more about moral knowledge on Wednesday, our last class.